L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Hello and welcome to Who Are You, the podcast about what it means to be a football fan. From documentaries delving into the heart of a football club to special guest interviews exploring the origins of their fandom, every fan and every club has a story to tell, and we want to tell it. Over the course of this podcast, we will attempt to discover what really matters to fans, placing their stories in a broader footballing context. And with a new episode released every other Friday morning, it's the Who Are You fans who support by far the greatest team the world has ever seen.
Welcome to this episode of Who Are You Talks. Sorry if you were expecting the dulcet tones of Ben Cartwright, but I'm afraid you're stuck with me, David Cowlishaw, for the intro to this particular podcast. Don't worry though, we'll make it through. On this episode, I chat to Thomas Perez, better known as Pez, or at Pezitivity to his Twitter followers. To bring you up to speed, Pez is, to quote from his Twitter bio, co-founder of Football Beyond Borders, creator at Copper 90, filmmaker, coach, mentor, activist, baller, and head of media at Wanderers AFC. But since the show is called Who Are You, we'll let Pez answer that question himself. Who are you and what do you do?
So, my name is Pez, full name Thomas Tembincosi Rodriguez Perez. What do I do? I guess it's a very good question. I recently had this conversation with my girlfriend, who is a film director. Last night we were talking about when you can call yourself a filmmaker, because recently I've been going around calling myself a filmmaker. And she's someone who's been involved in the film world for a lot longer than I have, so I can legitimately call herself that. But we had this philosophical discussion because I've been shooting films for Football Beyond Borders, and kind of in that kind of world of freelance filmmaking recently with Copper 90. And it's something that I feel proud to call myself now, and it's something that I want to do more and more of. So I would call myself a filmmaker now, but what have I kind of done and who am I in the past is probably going to emerge through the rest of this podcast. But I guess you could say I'm someone that's worked in the charity sector. I'm someone that's passionate about creating social change through powerful storytelling, I guess, and filmmaking is currently the way that I do that.
Okay, fantastic. And in these interviews, we like to talk about not just what people do in terms of their work and their hobbies, but how you got into football and kind of what your story of your football support is. So I was wondering if you could shed some light on how you got into football and what kind of guided you towards following the game.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty simple one for me in terms of kind of football has been a massive narrative thread throughout my life. It's been the tool that has allowed me to connect with the variety of different cultures that I've lived in. So I grew up in Zimbabwe in Southern Africa, the son of parents who had been Spanish missionaries, so Catholic missionaries as well. So my father was a priest from Tenerife. My mother was a nun from Burgos in northern Spain. They both moved to Zimbabwe at separate times during the 60s and 70s, I think. They were there as missionaries. And they eventually, with the whole political turmoil at the end of the 1970s and the liberation of Zimbabwe from the oppression of Rhodesian rule, they became teachers and decided to leave the church, get married, and be part of the new Zimbabwe. So I was born in the new Zimbabwe and independent Zimbabwe in 1988. And growing up as a kid, it was a really beautiful time to be in Zimbabwe, because even though I was white and of white, you know, European origin, I still felt very much like very, very Zimbabwean. All my friends were young black Zimbabwean people. I went to a normal you know, public Zimbabwean primary school where probably there was about 10 white people out of 1,000. So it was just a very interesting, you know, cultural mix. But I never really saw race at that time as something as divisive as it often is nowadays in the modern world, and as it became in Zimbabwe as well. So actually football was the thing that helped me to connect to my peers and to kind of blow away a lot of these divisions. As a kid, it was the thing that, you know, brought me out of my house every day. It's the thing that brought me, you know, kind of a cultural glue and got me to meet loads of other young Zimbabweans and to actually learn the local language. Because although my parents spoke English, which is also a national language in Zimbabwe, Shona is one of the tribal languages, and thanks to football, that was something that I was able to learn with my peers. Interestingly, in Zimbabwe, you can support as many teams as you want. It's often the case in Africa. So growing up, I supported Aston Villa and Chelsea because that's at the time Dwight York was banging goals in for Aston Villa, and I used to watch the Premier League Global Show. And also at the round about the same time, Chelsea had that brilliant kind of Italian era of Zola, Viali, Casiraghi, and that really got me into kind of that flair football. And so yeah, growing up, that's what kind of opened up the kind of global world of football. But also in Zimbabwe, as kids, we all loved Premier League football, and it was something that really connected us to the world.
Okay, that's interesting, because I often wonder how the English game is followed in places like Africa. And as you mentioned there, that you said you could support as many teams as you like, and we kind of take for granted how global the Premier League is. So what were your peers' teams, what was the basis of their support, where did and what was kind of your exposure to the English game? You mentioned the goal show there. Was how pervasive was the Premier League at that time?
Well, it was pretty interesting because we only had one Zimbabwean kind of television channel, national television channel, which was also then later used a lot for propaganda. And you know, it wasn't like you had the range of choices that you have nowadays, you know, with satellite television. And that did eventually come to Zimbabwe. We did have this South African broadcaster called SuperSport that still exists, but it was very hard to get. So growing up, we all just had that one Premier League weekly roundup show. And I think the biggest teams at the time were definitely Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal. And I would say that's still the case in Africa, even with the emergence of Man City and Chelsea, you know, in the money years, the money era of the early 2000s and beyond. But growing up, it was very much, yeah. And people would support, I'm not even joking, some people would support Liverpool and Man United, which obviously to an English audience might sound ridiculous, but it was very much about appreciating the beauty and the excitement of the Premier League, because it was really well packaged. I'm not going to lie. It was so exciting. And that's not to say we didn't have local Zimbabwean football that we loved about, that we loved and talked about all the time. Growing up, I was a Caps United supporter. Now Caps is the pharmaceutical team in Zimbabwe. So also has interesting, those origins of, you know, some teams, you know, like happened in Britain at the beginning of when football was evolving, there was, you know, engineers teams or, you know, industrial teams. That's still quite a thing in Zimbabwe. So I supported Caps, and there was also Dynamos. There was lots and lots of teams that you could support, but it wasn't the same because you couldn't see the highlights on the telly. And it was quite, you know, going to a stadium wasn't something that my parents would do that often. So it was only the Premier League that we would all discuss at school, because it was something that we would watch and we'd all pretend to be our favourite players. I was obsessed with being Dion Dublin or Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank. You know, that was what we did, and that's how we kind of became so enamoured with the Premier League. And yeah, it just kind of evolved. And I think still to this day in Zimbabwe, at least, the Premier League is watched fanatically. And people really, even though they support all their own local stuff, they look to the Premier League as a kind of, I don't know, the nadir, the top echelon of football. And it's, you know, even though people also watch other leagues, it's still the Premier League that dominates, I think, in Africa.
You told me before the interview that you're currently mostly a Dulwich Hamlet fan, and you lived in Zimbabwe until you were 14. So take us from being a Chelsea/Villa supporter in Zimbabwe to supporting Dulwich Hamlet.
Yeah, it's a bit of a turnaround, and I would never have heard of Dulwich growing up. So the way it happened was quite interesting. I moved here when I was 14. My parents stayed in Zimbabwe at the time, so there was a lot of political turmoil. It was the it was just after the economic crash in the late 90s, the farm invasions as well, that Mugabe was known so kind of famously or infamously for at the time, and it just led to a real political and economic disruption in Zimbabwe. So my parents wanted me to secure a better education, so they sent me over to London, where my best friend's family lived. My best friend growing up in Zimbabwe had already moved to London as he had English parents. So he was actually living in Tottenham or near Tottenham. He was a Tottenham fan, so for him it was like, oh great, I'm near Tottenham. But he was actually in Enfield roughly. And so I ended up moving in with him in a house where the whole family was split up between Arsenal and Tottenham. So they were all pressuring me to support either Arsenal or Tottenham and saying, you know, you have to support your local team. But having, you know, been a Chelsea and Villa fan in Zimbabwe, I kind of thought, well, I can't really support Villa now I'm in London. I can still, you know, have them as like, have a soft spot for them. But I think, you know, Chelsea made sense at the time. That was 2002, the year before Abramovich joined, right? Mm. So I come here, I start supporting Chelsea. They get that famous equaliser against Liverpool in the last minute, I think, when Gronkia scored, and Chelsea basically came fourth that season. I was so happy. I was like, wow, I'm going to be able to watch Chelsea in the Champions League next season. And then Abramovich took over that summer, and literally all the Arsenal and Tottenham fans in my house turned against me. Everyone at school turned against me. It was like, oh, you're a glory hunter. That's all you care about. And to be honest, it was something that was quite difficult for me, because I've always had this identity of, you know, caring about social justice and wanting some kind of equality somewhere. You know, even at 14, 15, that was something that really played on my mind. So yeah, it was a difficult time to be a Chelsea fan, because obviously I loved the footballers that we signed and the kind of football that we went to play and the exciting journeys, you know, even with Ranieri, that crazy Champions League where we almost got to, I think we got to semi-finals against Monaco and got knocked out. But it was just very exciting for me as someone who'd never seen their team in the Champions League. That was really exciting, but at the same time frustrating, because everyone was telling me we were buying the league, and you know, it was a very interesting time. And I think I got more and more disillusioned with Chelsea as the Mourinho years kind of developed. And as I think the moment that really ruptured my love for Chelsea was the season where I think it was Mourinho's second coming, and he had that whole thing with Eva Carneiro, where, you know, the Chelsea female doctor, where he ended up telling her off for coming on to sort out Hazard's injury. And, you know, something that any medical doctor would have done, but he ended up being really condescending, misogynistic. And you know, it was horrible. And someone who I'd seen as a hero, I really idolized Jose Mourinho. I think that was the final straw, because whilst I could put up with, you know, being a club that spent loads of money, because I saw all around me, I mean, United had spent loads of money, loads of clubs were spending money. So I didn't really feel so bad about that anymore. But that, you know, that rupture and seeing the club not stand by Carneiro, and it just really made me realize that, look, these Premier League clubs, and not just Chelsea, most Premier League clubs don't really value these social norms and social justice that much anymore. They just care about winning. And that same season I'd been to watch Chelsea. I think we were playing Burnley. It was just before Mourinho got sacked. I think it was Burnley or Bournemouth. It was Bournemouth. And we were 1-0 down, and I was sitting in Stamford Bridge, an absolutely silent, negative Stamford Bridge. And I thought, right, let me try and cheer my team on. And I'm there with a kid from Football Beyond Borders who we'd managed to bring along for his first ever live Chelsea experience, a massive Chelsea fan. And he couldn't understand why all of our fans were being so negative. So the two of us started cheering and trying to, like, you know, raise the morale. And our own fans told us to shut up. And that was a really, really tough experience for me, because I thought, wow, you know, this is this kid's first Chelsea experience. This is, you know, my club that I've followed for a long time and that I have every right to support. And my own fans are telling me to shut up just because it doesn't fit in with their narrative. And they're not winning and they're not happy. Fair enough. But, you know, to tell one of your own fans to stop cheering the team is just, it just summed up for me what was wrong with Premier League football. So around about the same time, I'd been starting to go and investigate non-league football, and I'd been watching Clapton a lot, because I was really impressed with their social values, and I was interested in how social politics could be brought in and melded with being, you know, being a fan, that it was possible to be a fan and an activist at the same time. Now, obviously, the Clapton project has had its ups and downs, and at times it became a bit almost maybe too political for some people, and it blurred that distinction between being a fan and an activist, or in this case, an anti-fascist. I think there was a lot of issues around that. Still very much support Clapton and what they do, especially the new community club that's formed. But around the same time, Football Beyond Borders, which is the charity that I set up with my mates after uni, they were based in Camberwell, and we were looking for local football teams who could support the work that we did in South London. Thankfully, we heard about Dulwich, who were very local to us. At the time, they were still playing in Champion Hill, which is their local ground that they were later evicted from. So we used to go down there, and at first they gave us free tickets for the young people to come and watch games. Then they interviewed us for a podcast. They've got a great podcast themselves called Forward the Hamlet. And I met the guys from Forward the Hamlet. They were really welcoming. And eventually I just became a fan. I guess by going down so many times, the culture really, the inclusivity of it, the friendliness of it, the fact that you could have a drink in the stands, the fact that the fans had loads of songs, like really amazing pop culture songs that had just been modified and turned into beautiful kind of ballads. It was so different to Premier League football for me. It just really stuck out that this was much more of an appealing and exciting and enjoyable experience, and also far cheaper than going to watch Premier League. So I don't actually think I've been to see Chelsea since. I've been to see Chelsea Ladies, which is something I'm really excited about. But I just watch Chelsea on the telly now because I enjoy watching Hazard, and particularly the new Chelsea with Sarri. But when it comes to pure footballing experience, I don't think I've seen anything better than Dulwich in non-league.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate enough to go to Dulwich a couple of times, and like you say, it is a great atmosphere. And I went before the ground eviction, and the attendances there were fantastic. The bar, the welcome. I remember literally going in, just wandering, kind of almost wandering off the street, and the first person there happened to be the chairman, who shook me by the hand, and they had a closed donation for refugees, and the kind of social ethos, if you like, had its heart in the right place massively. And that appeal is, you know, you speak to a lot of people who go to non-league games, and they've got nothing but good words to say about Dulwich Hamlet. And it's a club we're hopefully going to feature one day on this podcast. But you mentioned there about Football Beyond Borders. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how that got started and your role there.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about Football Beyond Borders is that it started off as a student society. It started off as a bunch of students who really cared about football and who could see the power of football to allow for cultural exchanges and for connection between communities that maybe didn't even speak the same language. So initially, the whole borders thing started very much as physical borders. When I joined in 2011, it had already existed for 2 years. It was basically very tightly associated to the SOAS University football team. And every year, the idea was that the SOAS University football team would fundraise a certain amount of money during the year. And at the end of the year, they would go on an international tour to a country or countries that had been maybe misrepresented in the media, and that we personally knew very little about and wanted to explore more. So that first year, they went to, believe it or not, Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey. And this is Syria, obviously, before the destruction that has happened over the last 5 to 10 years. But it was a special moment for them because I'm talking about 20 to 25 year olds, basically, who had never done anything like this, and who just embarked on this tour, very naive. I'm sure all the other lads would accept that, but also with the heart in the right place. And what they achieved on that first tour was fantastic. They met loads and loads of different community groups and youth groups in those three countries, and they made a documentary as well, which is kind of where the whole filmmaking thing comes from in a way, because it's always been a part of Football Beyond Borders. So I missed out on that first one and the second one. I was doing my undergrad at Cambridge at the time, and I wanted to do a master's in African studies because I'd grown up in Zimbabwe, obviously, and I had that connection. I had this yearning to kind of reconnect to my roots. And I found out, I'd never heard of SOAS up until that point, but I found out
whilst looking for African Studies masters that they were the specialist place to do it, the School of Oriental and African Studies, right? So I applied there mainly because I'd looked online. I wanted to find out first if they had a decent football team, right? That was also an important criteria. So I looked online, found out that they had this this Football Beyond Borders project, and I thought, this is amazing. I just missed out on the second tour to Ghana, which was also a huge success. And I joined in that third year, and I was like, I wonder where they're going to go next. This is great. Managed to get into the football team. I'm not sure how. I trialed, and apparently at the trials, they thought I was like some kind of poor man's Gerard Piqué. I was wearing a Spain shirt and kind of just dominating at the back and playing football from the back, and probably the best trial I've ever done. So I managed to get into the team and got on really well with the lads. It was a real diverse mix of, you know, people from London who'd grown up in London, but from all over the world as well. We had a striker, a guy from Uruguay, who his understudy had been Edison Cavani when he was playing in Uruguay. So he was amazing. He was a good footballer and he had great stories. And then my two colleagues, who I later formed the actual charity version of Football Beyond Borders, the founder, a guy called Jasper Kane, who's British and who he was very involved in football himself. He was at Gillingham. He was actually, it was Ryan Bertrand who was, understudy was Ryan Bertrand was Jasper Kane's understudy, and Jasper didn't end up making it because Ryan was apparently better, and but Jasper then went on to university and to form Football Beyond Borders. So it was this beautiful diverse mix of people from London and from around the world who wanted to have these exchanges, and when I joined they decided that year that they were going to go to Palestine, right, which had always been a country, and that whole region really fascinated me, and the history of it. And it was a place where there's so much kind of social injustice going on. So we wanted to go and try and tell that story and be as unbiased as possible and literally tell the story from the eyes of a football team from London who just wanted to go to Palestine and explore what was going on. So we spent that year, 2010 to 2011, fundraising. We raised £20,000 for this tour. We somehow managed to plan an incredible experience going from Egypt into Palestine and then into Jordan to look at the refugee situation there, because Jordan has so many refugees who've left from Palestine who now are based completely in Jordan. So that whole, I think we were out there for a month and it blew our minds completely. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things that I think, we could go on for days about that whole issue. The main thing for all of us was that it really activated us politically and made us realize that Football Beyond Borders was a great vehicle for these cultural exchanges, but that it also could be a much more powerful vehicle if we could continue the work we were doing, but actually focus it maybe on London, a place where, you know, we all had our roots anyway. Then we thought we could even make more of an impact. And interestingly enough, it was the same summer as the London riots, which I think also played a really big part in making that decision to focus our activities in London. So from there, we kind of just, for the next 3 years, between 2011 and 2014, Football Beyond Borders, the society, kind of took a step back. Even though it would continue to be based at SOAS, we, myself, Jasper, and another colleague, Jack Reynolds, we all had our own jobs. Jasper was working at Citizens UK, which is a great community organizing organization. I was at Farm Africa, which is a charity that works in East Africa, but is also has a base in London. And Jack Reynolds was running, he was actually working in the justice system in London, working on things like youth offending. So it was something that was also, again, very close to what we were thinking about, because we realized that one of the main causes of the London riots was young people not having community centers, young people not having football programs that they could easily access, you know, especially in some of these deprived areas where, you know, you could literally find young people on the streets with nothing to do, with nowhere to go. And we just thought, look, we've had all these advantages. We've had a great education. We've had, you know, men's football to kind of give us discipline and structure. What if we could simply try and give a bit of that back and at the same time use it as a way of promoting education? So that's where it all started. It started with a bag of footballs on Kennington Park.
with just lads from the local community back in 2010, 2011, where we first started kind of putting on this weekly session. It quickly developed from there once we realized that actually football's in a part, you know, on an AstroTurf isn't enough. You need a kind of infrastructure and you need to go to where young people are. So we started working in schools, and we started working in some of the tougher schools in South London, using football as a kind of hook to keep kids, first of all, to get kids into the school and make sure that they turned up every week, but also to give the reason to stay an hour later so that we could work on not just education side of things, but also, you know, improving their attitude to learning, I think is the main thing. Getting them to be passionate about learning through the lens of football, so that eventually they'd be passionate about learning in general. And I think it's definitely, we can say now 4 years later that it's been a resounding success. There are now over 35 schools that we work in London, and this year is the first time that we'll be starting to work in the north of England as well, having previously set up trial projects in Birmingham. So it's very exciting. And even though I don't work there now full time, I still offer my services freelance and help them out with events as much as possible. We had a fantastic event last week, which is their annual showcase. And yeah, it's probably the proudest achievement I've ever had of anything I've ever done, because it's now changing lives on a daily basis through the power of football.
Well, that was fantastic, and a great advocacy of what they do. I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about kind of what their work entails, perhaps on a more kind of practical day-to-day basis. What kind of things will Football Beyond Borders be doing next week or the week after, for example?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty simple. It initially started as an after-school program, where we would turn up at a school, say at 3 p.m. The first one was on a Friday. So just imagine, right? A Friday, school in Croydon. Kids just want to get out at 3 p.m. and live their lives, right? But the idea being that if they stayed for an extra hour to do, initially it was just homework. We would support them on their homework, but actually do a lot of kind of mentoring alongside that. We'd do an hour of classroom-based activities and then an hour of football. That is the basic model that still exists today. But the actual education side has evolved a lot. We do a lot of what we call project-based learning, which is a big thing in America, which is basically, and actually starting to become quite big here, which is basically saying, look, young people, you know, young people in a school have been learning almost the same way for, you know, decades and decades and decades. You know, it's always a teacher at the front, loads of kids sat behind a desk, and they just have to listen. And obviously it works for some kids, but it doesn't work for all. So project-based learning is about saying, no, look, let's put projects and skills at the center of what kids do, because that's how they're going to work in the working world as well. Let's give them a task, a brief, say, of a project. Let's give them a timeline, say the project lasts 6 weeks, and some objectives of what they have to achieve at the end. And then all we do is provide the resources, and we facilitate. We allow them to learn freely and to use those resources as they want. And we are kind of there as guides. You know, it's a kind of guided learning process. And so some of the projects, just so you get an idea, it's a real range. It's not all just purely football themed. But just to give you an example of a football one that was really popular at the beginning with kids, the Messi-Ronaldo debate. Yeah, Messi Ronaldo is one of the most popular debates at any school you will go to still to this day. And it has been for the last 4 or 5 years. So it's something that really gets kids excited, because they all have an opinion. And once you give them resources, like all the different goals that have been scored, the different awards that the players have won, you know, you allow them to set the criteria and then to argue their points. So they've got 6 weeks to come up with either a presentation or a video, whatever kind of medium they want to use. And at the end of the 6 weeks, they present it to each other and to the coaches. And then to incentivize it, obviously, we try and include prizes and rewards. The whole Beyond Borders model still exists, in the sense that we try and take them outside of their social borders and their physical borders, say that their postcodes, and take them to other areas, either within London, take them to Wembley trips, or take them to, you know, football matches or even abroad. So we've taken kids to Barcelona in the summer. We've taken kids to Germany. We've taken kids to France. And this, you know, this for kids who've often never even left Croydon, it's a really powerful experience. So it is about, I think the key to the model is about matching their passions, which is often tends to be football, but as well as whatever other passions, often music is a big passion for a lot of young people, and trying to fuse them together and give the young people the opportunities to express these passions, but at the same time giving them a kind of academic rounding and allowing them to be able to express these things in a way that will benefit them at school as well. So it isn't purely about academic results. It's more about the passion. If we can get the passion and if we can get them into school and attending school and having the right attitude to learning, we believe that the results will come after that. They will naturally emerge. And we also believe that the school system is currently not set up for all people. There are so many young people that fall through the gaps, whether they have special educational needs or they're just not suited to the traditional form of teaching. So it's about showing young people that even if they won't necessarily be the best academically, there are so many other routes that they can follow, even within football. It's not just about being the top footballer. And that is something we explicitly avoided from the beginning. We were not there to develop elite footballers. If that is what they want to do, and if we can support them with that, that's great. And we can signpost them. But our main thing was to say to people, look, football is your passion. Be passionate about it. Do what you can with it, but also don't be obsessed with just becoming a footballer. You could become a coach, you could become a commentator, you could become an analyst, you could become a filmmaker. There are so many different things you can do with your passion for football. And I think we've seen a lot of great success from that, even from the first group of young people that we've worked with for, you know, say 2 to 3 years. We've now got one of them is a full-time staff member. His name's Lorenzo, and he has kind of taken my place as I was the head of comms at Football Beyond Borders. He's now kind of head of FBB Productions. He's a really talented filmmaker, far more so than I am. So he's, you know, at 18, he's already a full-time FBB staff member because of the passion and development he's shown. And then there's a young lady called Deborah, who is, I think she's 17 now. She's studying her A-levels, but she's also a part-time coach for Football Beyond Borders and helps us coach on our football programs. So that has been, I think, a huge success. And now the programs have developed so that it's not just because schools have seen the value of it. It's not just an after-school program. We have coaches working in schools directly in a variety of schools as well as pupil referral units, which is where a lot of kids who are excluded from traditional schools end up. So we're trying to work across the kind of education system, supporting kids mainly who are at risk of exclusion and trying to keep them in school and trying to keep them passionate about education.
Fantastic. And just one more thing on Football Beyond Borders before we move on to other things. I was wondering if you could just tell us about the most recent Football for All event, because it's something I noticed crop up on my Twitter timeline a lot more. I noticed Football Beyond Borders getting kind of a lot more publicity, and people like Jukanovic, the Fulham manager, was there, and Bertrand was there, I think. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that event and what that the aim of that event was.
Yeah, so that's our annual showcase. And it's definitely, for me, one of the most exciting events in football. I'm not saying that because I'm biased. I genuinely feel like it's a very unique event. My favourite events tend to be Kick It Out events as well. The Raise Your Game events that they do are brilliant because they, especially for young people, they get you into this network of people who want to do good with football, and they show you all the different things that you can do. And that's what I think is great. So what's unique about the Football for All events that we do every year is that it is very much youth-led, and it's all about the young people that we work with getting the opportunity to showcase their talents, to showcase also their voices, you know, their powerful voices, and to give them a kind of protagonism in a world where young people are often labeled as mindless or lazy or, you know, gang members. There's so many stereotypes about young people that I think this event blows right out of the water, because it shows that, you know, young people, if they're given the right environment and the right opportunities, they can flourish and they can be just as successful and sometimes more insightful than adults. So that was a really beautiful event last week. Thankfully, I got a call a week before the event from Jasper. I'd been away in Tenerife for 3 weeks, and he said, look,
We're going to have Ryan Bertrand and Slavisa Jokanović there. Please, could you help us with the media side of the event and getting some press coverage and really showing how amazing this event is to the world out there? So I'm glad you saw that. Obviously, did my job fairly well. Having those two stars there, I think, was important. You know, Jokanović and Ryan Bertrand are two big names in the world of football, and also two people who very much are into our vibe. And I think they saw, once they heard about what we were doing, we've got some great contacts in football, thankfully, through Guillaume Balague. He was our patron right from the beginning, pretty much, and he has always helped us get people down to these events. And the idea is to make it an event that, you know, obviously the star names are there, but it is the kids who end up being the stars of the show. The names are just brilliant because obviously they help us raise a bit of publicity, but also because they create this conversation, right? A lot of what we do at FBB, and especially at these events, is about creating an intergenerational conversation to publicize the talents that young people have, but also to make it more of a thing so that young people don't feel so separated from old people or older people, shall we say, because I would put myself in that bracket now that I'm 30. I think it's just about creating that space, right? Creating a really magical space where, you know, 300 people, I think it was, over 300 people that came down to Amnesty International. We hold it there every year. We always pack it out. And the energy in the room is incredible. We had young people sharing stories about the tough things they've had to overcome to be who they are today and to get to that stage. And the coaches themselves as well have incredible stories. And this year was themed around the theme, A Letter to My Younger Self, which is something that the Players Tribune have done really well with, you know, lots of different footballers writing a letter to their younger self. So that theme worked really well. We had coaches writing letters to their younger selves. We had the players doing it. We had Jokanović and Ryan Bertrand doing it as well. So that was really, yeah, it was a special event. And I would definitely say to people to go and check out the work that Football Beyond Borders do and to try and attend future annual showcases because, yeah, they're pretty inspiring. I left almost in tears, but tears of happiness because of, yeah, it feels like to me now for the rest of my life, no matter what I do, I can go back to that event and reap the rewards of something that I put so much of my time into. So very proud.
Fantastic. I'll just touch on a couple more things you're involved in. You've done some stuff for Copa 90 in the past, done some filmmaking for them. I was just wondered what your thoughts were on Copa 90 as kind of like potentially the future of football media. I don't want to kind of label them that if they've not asked for it, but it feels like a lot of football media now is moving away from your traditional forms of journalism to your big YouTube channels like Copa 90, to podcasts, to video content and things like that. And I just wondered if you thought that was the case with the Copa 90 and what you like about them as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, Copa 90 have been, for us at Football Beyond Borders at the time, they kind of inspired us a lot and they've been very supportive of the work we did. We basically realised early on that we didn't have much budget as a charity to do a lot of promotion of ourselves in kind of traditional charity promotion ways, you know, flyering and going over, you know, going over to people's houses or doing bucket shaking outside stations. It wasn't something that we had the resources to do. So we realized that social media was going to be the free way of doing it. And if we could tell powerful visual stories, which, you know, myself and Jasper, both coming from that filmmaking background, wanted to do, and we could see that the young people had an appetite to do it, then we thought, okay, let's try this ourselves. Let's try and move into this YouTube world. And so we looked up a lot to Copa 90, and they actually, in their early days, I'm talking 4 years ago, they would send people down to kind of do workshops with our young people and to teach them about filmmaking. So we've always been very thankful to them. I've kind of admired them both as a fan of their work and as someone that wanted to work there eventually. So I'm glad it ended up happening. And I do think that over the last 4 years, they have been one of the kind of leading names and also one of the leading change makers in this football media world, because I do think it is changing. I do think it is moving. I do think that traditional forms of media are, I wouldn't say dying, but I would say they are they're necessarily having to change because things are getting more visual.
And, you know, it's not that writing is any less important than it was before. I think there is still a really important space for long form writing. I'm still passionate about reading long form writing. But in this information age where information has become so saturated and there's so much information out there and people's attention span is just getting shorter and shorter, probably also the fault of social media. I would say that it's been impressive to see new media organizations coming out there who are cutting through a lot of the noise by creating really powerful either visual things or, like you guys have done, podcasts. I'm so into podcasts at the moment, and it's something that I've been trying to tell the guys at Copper to do, and I think they will do at some point. But yeah, it's great to that I think Copper have been one of those guys that have created that space, have challenged your Sky Sports and, you know, your other traditional football media outlets. And they've grown so much. That's the thing. I would say at the beginning, they were very much more into kind of doing the YouTube stuff, but now they're just a you know, multimedia platform. If anything, they could also be called a kind of creative agency, because your Nikes and your Adidas's and other brands will go to Copper because of the audience that Copper have, and they will design kind of campaigns and videos around that. And I think that is probably the side of football that a football media that maybe is less interesting to me. I'm much more interested in the powerful stories that are kind of separate from whatever influence that brands have. Not that I don't see the use of that and the importance of that in kind of the business models, but I'm very much, in terms of what Copper do, I'm very into the Derby Days stuff more than anything. I don't know if you've watched Derby Days. Mm. It's a really, really great series that one of the presenters there, Ellie Menjam, does, which is, you know, goes to all these different derbies. The recent one they just released on Hamburg and St. Pauli was amazing. And it's 30 minutes. And again, you know, that's why I'm really proud that even though they do a lot of short form stuff now, if you go on their social media, you'll see a lot of the short form stuff they do. They're still really proud of the long form stuff that they do on YouTube. And I still think they're definitely one of the best at what they do. So that was good. I worked there for 3 months over the World Cup, which was incredible. But in the London office, basically in the newsroom. And one of the big things we did, and one of the big things that is happening at the moment on the internet, is this whole movement of user generated content. At Copper have this amazing collective of content creators from across the world who send through their content. Especially during the World Cup, they were sending through loads and loads of content, and we would cut it up into different stories. And that was really exciting, because for me it was editing some incredible footage that was coming through from Russia and from all across the world, and that was great. And I think what Copper have also realized is that because there is so much of this UGC stuff going on, that I think for the good quality stuff, they realized they needed to start paying their contributors. So they've set up this filmmakers commission, which is really cool. Every month they have commission two films. Anyone can pitch an idea. And as long as they've got some kind of filmmaking background or ability to kind of film the stuff themselves, if Copper decide that that's a strong enough idea, I think they fund two ideas a month with, you know, hopefully enough funds to fund kind of low budget but good quality films. So that's something that people should look out for and apply for. It's definitely something that I'm pitching ideas to them for. But it was also good while I was there. Two ideas I pitched have been taken up and will be coming out in November. They're going to start a series of Facebook original films called Grassroots Legends. So look out for that. There will be one about this amazing referee called JJ, who I know really well, who has been involved in football beyond borders in the past and used to run our women's projects. She is a young Somali Muslim referee who wears a hijab and, you know, referees across games in London, non-league games and kind of Sunday league games and all sorts. And she is just the most amazing character. And watching her dish out discipline to, you know, massive burly men on a Saturday, Sunday is one of my favorite things to do. So look out for that film. That will be really, really cool. And yeah, look out for everything Copper are doing at the moment, because they are, I think they're always at the cutting edge. And there are many other YouTube platforms and media platforms that are coming out that are also at that cutting edge, like TIFO, for example, and many others. But I think Copper have this very distinct youthful voice that especially a lot of the young people in London are really into. And they follow two of the other presenters, Poet and Vooj, who are kind of influencers in this kind of space. It's not a space that I completely understand, and it's not a space that all, you know, traditional football fans understand that well. But I think it is a space that we need to respect, because young people love it and young people are the future. So it's one that I think Copper have, it's a line that Copper have navigated very well, because they appeal to quite different audiences. But yeah, it makes for a beautiful mix, I think.
Yeah, and Copper Natty were a massive influence on this podcast. I mean, our monthly documentary episodes on football clubs were kind of hugely influenced by those Ellie Mengham's documentaries for Copper Natty and stuff. And we try as possible not to copy Copper Natty, but to kind of take that spirit of their filmmaking style and try and translate that into the podcast we produce. So if we can get anywhere close to that, we've done a good job. I'm just a bit conscious of time, so I'll just have one more question for you, then I'll let you go. Just about kind of your attitude to football now. You've talked about how passionate you are about the work with Football Beyond Borders, and how you're massively interested in kind of social justice and things within the game can make you turn away from it. So things like the Eva Carneiro incident that you mentioned. I was just wondering how you kind of reconcile your passion and your desire for kind of more social equality with what the game, particularly at the top level, is, which can be often leave a really sour taste in the mouth. The kind of exorbitant wealth, the inequality at the top of the game, where that money comes from, and all the rest of it. How you kind of remain a massive football fan, and also have your kind of your social views, if you like.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's always a bit tricky, but I guess I've got a kind of two-pronged approach, which is, for me, one, as a football fan, is you have to be the change you want to see in football, right? It's very Gandhian, but it's something I definitely believe in. So for me, what I want to see in football is as many people as possible playing football, because I believe playing is a very important part of the game, if possible, playing for their local, whether it's Saturday or Sunday league team, and making that the basis of their passion for football, because I just believe that that's what for me is so powerful about football, not just the consumption of it on the telly, but very much the participation, whether it is as a fan going to games or as a player playing games on a Saturday or Sunday. So whether it's playing for your local team or supporting your local team, I think that is a really, really big thing for me. Unfortunately, I live in North London and I'm a bit of a nomad, because I actually don't play for my local team. I play for the Wanderers, which is a South London team, South London based team. They are in its original form, they were the first ever winners of the FA Cup. They won it five times and then collapsed in the late 1800s. But a good colleague of mine, Mark Wilson, reformed the club in 2009 with the authority and consent of the original family. He actually went and traced the descendants of the original family, the Alcocks, and got their consent to reform the club with the condition, and this is what I love, that it would be a community club that supported local charities. So that's actually how the Wanderers contacted Football Beyond Borders, because they that Mark contacted us, found out about what we were doing. And the Wanderers then put the logo on the shirt and agreed to donate, I think it was about £500 a year from player subs to Football Beyond Borders. So that's been, you know, I ended up going from being part of Football Beyond Borders to actually being part of Wanderers as well. And I still play for them. We play in the Surrey Southeast Combination League, which is, I think, somewhere 15 steps down from the Premier League. But, it's a beautiful experience, because we're a community club. At the moment, we're in the process of trying to have a pitch resurfaced remodeled, that is an unused school pitch that we want to turn into a proper football pitch. We want to buy all the equipment, the goals and everything, so that can be used not just by us, but by the local community in South London, in Gypsy Hill. So that's our big passion project at the moment. And that allows me to kind of reconcile some of my passions for football with the fact that actually football in its elite form is still in some way, I think, causing a lot of damage to society. But, you know, I also think that there is other ways. You know, you can still be a Chelsea fan and criticize Chelsea and criticize certain aspects of the culture. But I do think that if we don't do things ourselves, if we don't propose a certain other way of being, then it's very much just talk. You know what I mean? So for us, that way of doing it was through the Wanderers. We really try and model the right behaviors. We try and give opportunities to young people. We try and, you know, our coach is a 23-year-old guy called Joe Poxon, who is absolutely brilliant. He's, you know, he's only young, but he's so, so brilliant. I think he'll go a long way in football. And that is what we're about, you know, and that's what we want to see in other clubs. So hopefully if we can set an example, if we can have the right values, if we can play the right way, if we can shake the hands of the opposition, no matter how hard they've kicked us at the end of the game, you know, that's the kind of thing that football taught me as a young person and gave me so much pride to be involved in. So that's what I want to continue doing at a grassroots level, and hopefully that will inspire others.
Pez, that was brilliant. Thank you very much.
No problem. Absolute pleasure to be on the show. Really enjoyed listening to your podcast about Brent, I'd heard a lot of stuff about you guys, and I'd kind of dipped into little bits and bobs, but the Brentford one was really, really good. And I think I'll be definitely listening to all your future podcasts. And please do come down to Dulwich, because I think if anyone can cover it and in all its glory, it's you guys. So
that's very nice of you. Thank you very much.
No problem, David.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Who Are Your Talks. Thank you very much to Pez for being a fantastic guest. A reminder that you can follow us on social media to keep up with what we're planning next. That's Who Are Your Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with our usual documentaries. The next episode will be looking at Fleetwood Town, so check that out. And if you can, please drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. They really mean a lot to us. See you in a couple of weeks.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.